Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, creating bathrooms for daily rejuvenation. More at callmosby.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. One of the most rote phrases uttered during the last 5 or 6 years is how we're living in unprecedented times. And there's some truth there. None of us experienced a global pandemic like COVID-19 or the shocking insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. But America's relatively brief existence is littered with plenty of things that resemble current events in 2025, especially when it comes to stark political divisions. NPR's Steve Inskeep wrote Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America, about how Abraham Lincoln dealt with ideological divergence as he ascended to the presidency. We talked with Inskeep about the release of his book in 2023, and now upon the release of his book in paperback this month, he's coming back to St. Louis to talk about it again. In an event presented in partnership with the Missouri Historical Society and St. Louis Public Radio, Inskeep will be at the St. Louis County Library's Clark Family Branch this Wednesday at 7 p.m. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Steve Inskeep, one of the hosts of NPR's Morning Edition and Up First. Steve, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Jason. Thanks for the invitation.
Your book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America, was released in 2023. Today's political environment feels and is very different with the new administration.
I can hear the change in your tone of voice. Please proceed. Go ahead.
It seems like you've done this radio thing for a while. Are you thinking about your book tour now in different ways that you might have not have thought of in 2023?
Well, clearly a lot of things have changed in terms of who the president is and what the agenda is, but a few things haven't changed. We still live under the same small R Republican system of government. We have a republic. It's democratic. There are checks and balances. There are different branches of government, and they are called upon to fight it out. And we, as citizens, are called upon to participate. All of that stuff was true in 2023. I would assert that all of that stuff is true in 2025. I think that the new Trump administration is being fairly explicit that they want to change the accepted rules of the game, and they argue that they can do so within the bounds of the Constitution. Democrats are arguing that they are vastly exceeding a president's powers and authority, and the courts are beginning to referee on that. That is the system that we have and that we have had. And I appreciated your introduction. My study of history reminds me that human nature doesn't change much, that our basic system of government has yet to change very much. The events do change. We're not in the middle of a new civil war, as Abraham Lincoln was, but we can learn from that time.
Well, you probably gathered, I love American history. One of my greatest achievements in my entire life is getting a 5 on the AP US test when I was in high school.
Congratulations. And, isn't that the top grade? I think it is.
It is. And I also got a 5 on AP Euro, too, which was much harder.
I sometimes got 5s in school, but that was on a 100-point scale. So please proceed. Go on.
Yeah. I often find commonalities with things that happened decades or centuries ago to provide context to the present state of our country. So with the caveat that no time period in American history is identical, can you point to a period of time in the United States' history that is similar to 2025?
Yeah, well, let's make the comparison with the Civil War period. The essential thing that I ended up writing about with Abraham Lincoln, who, as you know, has been written about a little bit before, was his effort to build political coalitions. Doris Kearns Goodwin has a great book about Lincoln that became a movie that tries to focus on his team of rivals, the individuals who were on his side, who also wanted to be president, thought they should have been president. I attempted a slightly different task in figuring out how Lincoln dealt not just with those individuals who were basically on his side, but people who were on the other side or on seemingly no side, and how he tried to bring them into his coalition or try to outmaneuver or manage them if he couldn't bring them to his side. I think that was the essential problem of democracy then. Lincoln succeeded to the extent that he kept the majority of states behind the Union in the Civil War, and as a result, they had more population, more money, a bigger army, and they won the war. The war was a kind of election by other means, and the majority ruled. That building of coalitions is our central challenge today, and we just went through a coalition-building election. I think the Democrats believed, until a few months ago, that they had the broader coalition, that they had the wider collection of different kinds of people and beliefs that they could bring together under one tent of supporting the Constitution as they see it and supporting the United States as they see it. And they found out that in this particular election, it was Republicans who built a slightly bigger, very, very slightly, but bigger coalition and brought different kinds of people into their tent, got more, for example, minority voters than many people expected them to do, and prevailed. And now Democrats face a challenge again. It's their turn to try to see if they can rebuild a larger coalition in a giant country where we are all free and where we all have a voice. And we're going to not have all the same opinion. It'd be terrifying if we all had the same opinion. That coalition building is what it's all about.
One thing that was definitely not around in the 1850s and 1860s was social media platforms. And there's plenty of anecdotal evidence and polling data out there that news consumers are getting information on places like TikTok, Instagram, X, Facebook, rather than traditional news outlets. I assume most people got news in the 1850s and 60s with newspapers, since radio didn't exist then.
Yeah.
How do you think that's affecting how people view politics now?
Well, I think that there is some information for me in history. I think the fundamental thing that's happened to us is that information is coming at us a lot faster than it was, and we don't often know what to believe. And even if the things that we're told on social media are true, are they relevant? Are they the most important thing? Are they the only thing? Lincoln's era had a similar challenge. There was a dramatic increase in the amount and the speed of communications. Weekly newspapers became daily newspapers. Railroads carried those newspapers across the country from one city to another. The telegraph sped news from one city to another almost instantaneously. This had never happened before. When you read the initial accounts of the telegraph, which I put in an earlier book from 1844, the newspaper accounts of what was going on are a little like people gazing in wonder at the early years of Facebook. Wow, we can get all of these opinions from the other side of the world instantly. Those are the kinds of things people were saying then. It affected American politics at that time in real time, and I give examples. Policymakers were getting instant, emotional, divisive, partisan news events and faced pressure to respond to them instantly rather than thoughtfully. And that was, I believe, a divisive force. And we've had our own wave of that in an even more extreme way in recent times.
Well, to continue on this theme of commonalities, I've noticed that when I was watching the inauguration of President Trump, there were all these social media platform barons on the platform with him. And that brings to mind old school newspaper publishers who got directly involved in politics. William yeah. Randolph Hearst is the obvious example there. How would these tech barons' attempts to influence federal policy and politics compare to how media executives of old attempted to showcase their influence with politicians?
There really is something unusual about having such very wealthy people on the inaugural stage, and we have to decide how we want to interpret that. Were they showing their power and influence? Were they showing that they have been overawed and captured by the new administration? We've heard both interpretations on NPR, by the way, and I think it depends on the particular mogul you're focusing on, and it also depends on the lapse of time, who actually prevails here in this struggle. But it's unusual to have that very close and public display. It is not unusual to have rich people in the proximity of government. It is not unusual to have people with business interests who want to influence the United States government. It totally happened in Lincoln's time. And there were media figures in Lincoln's time who were very powerful. The first one who comes to mind is James Gordon Bennett, who had this mass circulation newspaper in New York, the New York Herald. And if you go back and read the old accounts of the New York Herald, a lot of it is like really good, really interesting, really vividly written. And a lot of it is also like nasty and cynical and racist and unfair and hard to know what to make of it. And Bennett himself was a tremendously influential figure. People who criticize the media are not wrong that the media can be very influential and very politically powerful. And it does create a challenge for those of us who are trying to provide valid information for our audience, regardless of their politics, so that they can make up their own minds about things. That is a very special challenge that has never been the unanimous function of the media writ large. And right now, I would say the mainstream media are and include some of the cable TV partisan channels and some of the big YouTubers and so forth. I mean, Joe Rogan is the mainstream media. He's got a huge audience. We're just trying to do something a little bit different, which is to go see things for ourselves and not just talk about them in a studio, and to go learn facts and get different and opposing points of view about something before we pronounce any particular opinion about it, and to make sure that we convey to you, the listener, a bit of information so that you can do your job as a citizen. We're citizens, and we're trying to inform our fellow citizens.
I do want to talk about another phenomenon that has emerged, especially after Trump was inaugurated, and that's news fatigue. Because non-journalists I've talked to have been pretty exhausted about politics and current events and have coped with paring down how much news they consume. Maybe they watch the Grammys or the NBA instead of NPR or reading the New York Times. What do you think about people who do this?
It's totally understandable. There's a lot to take in. There's a lot of stress, and a lot has gone on in people's lives over the last number of years. Each presidential election has been dramatic and stressful, the last several of them. The pandemic was huge and dramatic and stressful. The economic stresses of these times have been difficult. The speed of change in technology has been dramatic and difficult. So you totally understand why people check out. I think two things come to mind. I will blame, quote unquote, the media for some of that, because I do think that, and I would include social media people in this, come to think of it. I mean, this is some mainstream reporters, but it's also social media figures, YouTubers, Instagram influencers, all kinds of people. There is a tendency to wildly overstate every single development as being the end of humanity, the end of civilization, an utter disaster. There is something about our media infrastructure that favors bad news and proclamations of bad news and invocations of fear and other emotions like that. And people do get tired of it. And I think they deserve to get tired. They should be tired of it. I don't want to say NPR, really, to be honest with you, but those of us who are collectively talking to the public have cried wolf a few too many times, many too many times. And I think that people are understandably turning away from that. At the same time, I think that we all have a job as citizens to pay attention, and we do need to pay regular and constant attention because we are the ones who maintain our own freedom. Nobody else really does that for us.
Well, and my last question for you, you mentioned the fire hose of news.
Yeah.
How do you as a journalist deal with this deluge of information and combine it with what I just mentioned of people being kind of fatigued about news and do the most effective job possible in informing the public?
I try to apply the same format to all kinds of news that I have learned to apply to plane crashes. We had a tragic collision the other day, a collision of a jetliner and a helicopter. Many, many years ago, when I was a reporter, I covered transportation, and so I did a number of plane crashes. And I learned to be patient, to not jump to instant conclusions, and to stop trusting people who jump to instant conclusions, because plane crashes tend to be very complicated. There are all sorts of safety systems, and typically multiple things have to go wrong for the plane to go down. If just one thing goes wrong, usually the plane stays up because it's redundant and it's very, very safe. And it's a matter of science and investigation and sometimes human nature and social science even to figure out how a particular crash took place. And that takes time. And I try to apply that patience as a news consumer also. I want to pay attention to the media that give a thoughtful look at something, that return to the story a day later or a week later or a year later to see how it might look a little bit different, and that do not proclaim conclusions instantly based on little or no information. That's how I try to weed it down as a citizen, whatever the story is.
Steve Inskeep is one of the hosts of NPR's Morning Edition and Up First, and he'll be at the St. Louis County Library's Clark Family Branch this Wednesday at 7 p.m. to discuss Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
And by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.